The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
In a solitude of the sea, deep from human vanity and the pride of life that planned her, stilly couches she.
Steel chambers light at the pyres of her salamandrine fires. Cold currents thrid and turn to rhythmic tidal lyres.
Over the mirrors meant to glass the opulent, the sea worm crawls, grotesque, slimed, dumb, indifferent.
Jewels in joy designed to ravish the sensuous mind lie lightless, all their sparkles bleared and black and blind.
Dim moon-eyed fishes near gaze at the gilded gear and query, what does this vaingloriousness down here?
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And we began with the first five stanzas of Thomas Hardy's epic on the sinking of the Titanic, The Convergence of the Twain. We didn't read the whole poem because I think the first half's better than the second half. Do you remember that one, Robert?
No, I'm not as up on this one. But it now seems that we should have read this in one of the many voices of the actor Tom Hardy. That would have been that would have been lovely.
Yeah, that would have been good. Or do a Billy Zane impression from the movie Titanic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one of the interesting things about this poem always is that it was supposed to be like a memorial for the sinking of the Titanic, but there's just like not even a hint of sadness or grieving for the lives lost. It's just like celebrating the irony of the ship sinking.
Yeah, and in this section that we read here, there's just a lot of almost kind of ghoulish gloom.
Uh-huh.
Obsessing with just sort of the mysterious nature of the shipwreck.
Yeah, so there's the irony of the opulence going down and then being surrounded by the worm and the moon, dim moon-eyed fishes that swim around at the bottom of the sea, because that is a really captivating image, isn't it? Like taking this, like the ultimate emblem of human vanity and riches and mechanical design and opulence and all that, and then putting it down at like the deepest hell there is on planet Earth, the bottom of the North Atlantic. It is kind of the ultimate irony, the ultimate middle finger from nature. But of course, shipwrecks are a thing that, you know, it's not like the Titanic was the first ship to ever sink. In fact, I think maybe we should start with the trivia question. We know the answers from the for this because we discussed it ahead of time. But I want you, the listener out there, to think about this trivia question. How many total shipwrecks do you think there are on the bottoms of the world's oceans going back through all human history?
You know there's at least one because we just referenced the Titanic. And despite that one film, nobody has raised the Titanic.
They make a movie where they brought it up? That happened?
Yeah, there was a film like Raise the Titanic, I think it was called. It was one of these it's not quite a disaster. It was on the heels of all the big disaster films, as I recall. I never saw it, but it had a really it was a really weird concept, it seems, for a film.
Okay. So the question is, how many total shipwrecks in human history? To be fair, estimates vary. Nobody can know this number. You just have to have a rough guess. So guess maybe on the order of magnitude that you would be thinking. Like, before I had read these answers or before I'd thought it through, I probably would have guessed maybe on the order of, like, I don't know, 50,000 or so. Even that seems like a lot, like 50,000 ships. Ships are huge. Maybe it couldn't be that many. But let's look at some external answers according to a few experts. So according to the mass market adventure novelist and underwater explorer Clive Cussler, who—
I always forget that he was also an underwater adventurer.
Yeah. So you see his books in every airport bookstore. I think he writes— I don't know. I've never read one, but I think they're like adventure novels about like, oh, a submarine sank and somebody has to go down and get the treasure out of it. I don't know if submarines carry treasure. I may be mixing genres there, but it's all underwater stuff. And so, but he's an actual underwater explorer as well. And in his foreword to a book about shipwrecks by the archaeologist James Delgado, there are more than 1 million shipwrecks from history, from the history of human civilization. And actually, there are estimates that are even higher. A figure often cited by the Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission of UNESCO, they've cited that the best estimate is about 3 million. Or even over 3 million.
And of course, that's gonna entail everything from dinghies to treasure barges.
Yeah, but even then, that's it. That is such a high number. How could there be 3 million shipwrecks at the bottom of the ocean? It just seems impossible. But then I started trying to do the Fermi estimation thing and thinking through it that way. Okay, just work with some round numbers. Assume humans have been sailing the oceans at some significant scale for maybe 10,000 years. Obviously, we've been sailing a lot more in recent centuries.
Right. Even if they're not venturing out across vast bodies of water, they're at least hugging the shores. They're at least going out to fish. They're at least using channels to move around.
Exactly. Now, simply assume an average, and this is going to be a very rough average because it's going to vary a lot over the different years, but a rough average of 100 shipwrecks per year over 10,000 years. Now, obviously, that wouldn't be even close to evenly distributed, but that already gets you to 1 million. Just 100 shipwrecks a year for 10,000 years, you're at 1 million already. Now, think of all the times when shipwrecks surge, say, during war between big naval powers or during horrible storms, hurricanes, cyclones. Think of the literally thousands of ships that were sunk during World War II alone. And suddenly, 1 million shipwrecks does not only seem not impossible, it seems quite, like that seems maybe kind of low.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're left more with just a consideration of how many shipwrecks remain even remotely identifiable as a shipwreck.
And the vast, vast majority of shipwrecks out there are completely unexplored. We might know where some of them are, like they've been mapped in some way, but nobody's ever been to them.
And that's a tantalizing idea.
Yeah.
We all love the idea of an unexplored shipwreck, especially considering that there might be treasure down there. There might be some sort of a monster down there. I mean, it's the stuff of so many wonderful, speculative bits of fiction, or even more believable fare like The Deep. I believe what the plot in that is, isn't it, that there's a World War II era a vessel with a bunch of morphine on it that sunk, and it's like sunk on top of a treasure vessel from the colonial days, like a Spanish treasure.
Is this
ship.
The one with Nick Nolte and Robert Shaw?
Yes, I believe so.
Despite my love of Robert Shaw, I've never seen this one.
Yeah, it was one of the big ones, right?
I got to get on that. That's like 70s cinema, right?
Yeah, classic 70s cinema.
Okay, yeah, that may view it this weekend. But, you know, I think one of the stupidest things about people exploring underwater shipwrecks in movie – underwater shipwrecks, the ones that happen under the water, shipwrecks in movies is that they're always looking for treasure when, in fact, the real treasures are not silver and gold and they're not even morphine. The real treasures of shipwrecks are the bizarre, interesting adaptations of ocean life to our sunken seaborne cities.
Exactly. Now, the previous episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind was all about the things that live and thrive in, on, and certainly on aboard, even in the riggings of functional sea vessels. And now we're dealing with sea vessels that have sunk into the bottom of the ocean.
So what happens immediately after that depends on several factors. So the ship goes down, and what happens depends on the size of the ship, where it falls, the intensity of the impact when it hits the bottom. And this is probably maybe something you don't often think of. Like when you live down in the ocean, there are boats and cargo ships and 50,000-ton battleships floating above you all the time. And if something goes wrong, they can fill with water and they lose their buoyancy and they come crashing down on your head. The only equivalent I can imagine is if like ship-sized objects were falling down on us from space or from the sky at a rate of dozens or hundreds of times per year.
And then we're just lost, in most cases, just lost to whatever was losing those ships. They're like, oh, well, it's down there somewhere. Maybe we can find some of them. We can retrieve things from some of these wrecks, but that's about it.
Oh, yeah. What if 200 airplanes every year were like the size of a battleship? They crashed somewhere on Earth and nobody ever went in to clean it up. It just stayed wherever it fell.
Yeah. And certainly that's the case when an airplane crashes into the ocean in many cases. I mean, flights have been lost. Just as ships have been lost throughout human history.
Yeah, so you've got this introduction of this new thing into the underwater ecosystem. So we were wondering what happens to the life below when a ship comes down. I found one discussion of this in a book called The Biology of Disturbed Habitats by Lawrence R. Walker from Oxford University Press, 2012. And so in this book, he's generally looking at ways that humans disrupt natural ecosystems and habitats. And one of the many things he looks at is a shipwreck. So he says, number one, of course, more damage is caused by shipwrecks in shallow water where biodiversity is already high. You can imagine this, like if there's a coral reef or something, mm-hmm. Shipwreck comes down on that, it's initially going to crush a bunch of life and screw things up.
Right. And we'll get to at least one example of this later on in the episode. It's when the ship falls into essentially a wasteland. I guess that's where there's considerably less harm and potentially room for things to flourish.
Yeah. Well, there's room for things to flourish in both cases, but there are also negative trade-offs as well.
Right. Well, like if it damages, if it, yeah. if it heavily damages a coral reef and introduces room for some organisms to thrive, it's like, you know, did we really end up ahead here? We damaged
right.
a vital part of the ecosystem.
Well, even in all the cases we'll talk about, there's some difficulty calculating the net benefits mm-hmm. and detriments caused by a sunken ship. But we'll get into that in a minute. So obviously, as you hinted to, yeah, where it's out there in the deep, where the bottom might be a wasteland, where there's just sort of not much going on the bottom of the ocean, which is true for much of the ocean. Like a lot of the ocean has sandy or muddy bottom mm-hmm. without a ton of biodiversity or closely, you know, densely compacted life. And so when a ship sinks out in deep water where biodiversity is lower, the initial impact tends to be less. But as we've been alluding to, shipwrecks are known to have both positive and negative long-term consequences for underwater biodiversity. So negative consequences can, of course, come in the form of like the initial impact crushing stuff and screwing up a reef or anything like that. But they can also come in the form of, say, a ship disintegrating over time and leaking toxic substances over time into the water. One example might be fuel or other chemicals that are in the structure of the ship itself or some kind of chemical purpose, say, within the engine.
Yeah, because, in many of these cases, we're dealing with a fully functional vessel that mm. has sunk due to, say, an attack by a military vessel or, storm situation, et cetera.
Sabotage.
Yeah, or sabotage. It's going to have fuel aboard. Mm-hmm. And there are even very notable cases where a vessel is intentionally sunk for testing purposes,
but still with tons of fuel on board.
Ugh.
One example I came across of this was the plight of the German heavy cruiser Prince Eugen, captured by the United States in World War II, and then cobbled into part of this ghost fleet that the military put together, along with the aircraft carrier Saratoga, the battleship New York, more than 80 warships in total. And they put this motley crew together and then anchored them at Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands in order to hit the fleet with two nuclear attacks.
Oh, no.
To see what happens when you hit a fleet with an atomic weapon.
They thought, like, the ships might be okay in the atomic blast.
Well,
I mean, I guess they didn't know a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. But here, this is a summary of the results from a Popular Mechanics article by Kyle Mizukami. Quote, Prince Eugen survived the blasts, but she became frightfully radioactive. After initial attempts to decontaminate the ship, the U.S. towed the heavy cruiser to Kawajalian Atoll, where she sank 6 months later. So the ship survived these atomic detonations.
Whoa.
Today, the ship is visible just off the coast of Enubuj Island, upside down in shallow water, her propellers resting above the surface of the Pacific Ocean. Now, by the 1970s, though, there was significant concern from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that oil might leak from this wreck, oil that fortunately was not radioactive. That was one of their concerns. They checked on that to make sure that we weren't dealing with the potential of not only leaked oil but leaked radioactive oil. But still, the U.S. Army, Navy, and the Republic of Micronesia, they all embarked on a salvage mission to retrieve its something like 2,767 tons of oil.
Which were still in there.
Still in there. That's how tanked up this vessel was. And this project was actually completed just last year with some 250,000 gallons of oil removed, about 97% of its holdings. And the remaining oil is said to be safely enclosed in a few internal tanks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things about all of these ships. Ships are artificial creations of human technology, and they have a fair amount of difficulty just thriving on the surface of the water. We've talked about the accumulation of barnacles,
yeah,
for example. So you sink it down to the bottom, things are just going to get rustier and rustier over time.
They don't stay contained forever, but Maybe some things can stay contained for a long time.
Yeah, at least they got 250,000 gallons of oil removed from this thing. Speaking of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I also was reading an article that mentioned in 2014 they completed a $5.5 million conservation project to remove three wrecked ships weighing a total of 1 million pounds from the Pacific Remote Islands National Wildlife Refuge. These wrecks had all occurred in the previous 15-year period, mm-hmm, and they had damaged the reef.
Oh, yeah.
So there's just an example of another case where we have shipwrecks, but they're in exactly the wrong spot, and then they have to be removed.
Right. So now we've discussed some of the obvious ways that a shipwreck can be very negative, can have very negative consequences, and especially in a place like a reef where there's, mm-hmm, already high biodiversity. There's already a lot of stuff living there. But Walker says that especially when you're looking at like the deeper ocean, he says, quote, shipwrecks have important ecological consequences that in some ways resemble those of carcasses.
Oh, like a whale fall.
Yeah. And so I was like, wow, I wish he would say more about that. He doesn't in this section, but I looked up his section on marine carcasses, and this was very interesting. I see what he's talking about here. So the effects of marine carcasses falling down to the bottom of the ocean. Walker summarizes some research in that, number one, he says that, so there's one study from 1989 that estimates there might be one gray whale carcass for every 300 square kilometers of ocean floor. So what happens when a whale falls to the ocean floor? Number one, of course, it depends on where it falls. But even in the benthic zone out there in the deep sea, when a whale carcass sinks, some opportunistic scavengers that specialize in unpredictable food sources, such as grenadier fish and some benthic invertebrates, will arrive and start eating a sunken whale carcass literally within minutes.
Mm-hmm.
In the example of one experimentally sunk whale carcass, crabs, sharks, and other fish had eaten the whale's flesh within a few months. And this was followed by a colonization of polychaete worms, which we'll get back to that in a bit. But so after that, sulfur-based chemosynthetic organisms show up, and these communities can exist within the ecosystem of the carcass for more than 5 or 6 years. And this suggests that fauna that normally live on deep ocean hydrothermal vents can also make a habitat out of a whale carcass, and we'll see as we go on, also out of a sunken ship.
Yeah, a whale's carcass, especially when you're dealing with the largest whales, this is a substantial amount of biomass to just have sink to the bottom. Like, and unlike with a number of other living creatures in the seas, it can sink to the bottom. Other things are going to have more potential to be consumed and torn apart in the upper layers till there's nothing left but like a faint rain of gray particles at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But here we can see the vast majority of the carcass can sink to the bottom and then become a community.
And if you're interested in this, I think, Robert, you and Christian had an episode about this from a few years ago, right, about whale fall and like the Osedax bone worm.
Yeah, I believe that was one of the episodes we did with Dr. Mara Hart, the author of Sex in the Sea.
So if you haven't heard that one, there's more for you to go back and check out.
Yeah, dealing with one of the highly specialized organisms that is all in on a whale carcass.
But I think it's fascinating how a whale carcass here can become not just a food source but a habitat in itself. And in much the same way, a sunken ship out in the ocean can become a habitat. Walker doesn't elaborate more on the relationship between his description of whale carcasses and sunken ships, but I said I would come back to this. So I looked into it, and there is a parallel about the colonization of whale carcasses by sulfur-based chemosynthetic bacteria. And we will discuss this after we get back from a break.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
All right, we're back. So we're on the subject of how a shipwreck can be kind of like a fallen whale carcass out in the ocean. And one of the ways that has been suggested is that there is a similar way that different organisms that often live around geothermal vents can colonize these fallen carcasses, whether it's an organic whale carcass or a mechanical monster carcass of a great ship. So I found an NOAA report on the marine wildlife colonization of a group of three 19th century shipwrecks in the Gulf of Mexico, known as the Monterey shipwrecks. And the authors of this report discuss these findings in a paragraph about tube worms. So here's the rundown. The ship remains show signs of vestimentiferan tube worms that get chemical nutrition from sulfides, which are produced by chemosynthetic bacteria. Now, these tube worms you will usually find growing near hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean, eating the byproducts of microorganisms. And this in itself is a wonderful and surprising discovery about nature, the life that surrounds deep sea hydrothermal vents. Up here on the surface in the sunshine, you know, we're used to living in food webs that are mostly traceable back to autotrophs that get their energy from the sunlight, right? So a crocodile eats a dingo, which ate a rabbit, which ate grass, and the plant matter in the grass was chemically synthesized sugar using the energy of the sun. It all comes from the sun.
And it kind of results in a heliocentric idea. For us humans, where we just think of all life as being more directly linked to the energy of the sun.
Yeah, there's quite a good reason for surface religions to have sun gods. Mm-hmm. You know, Helios is the true provider.
But there is another god in the deep.
Right. There is a Hadean god down there. Well, let's say the Hadean one is a goddess. Okay, she creates these awesome parallel trophic webs that don't have so much to do with sunlight. In some cases, not at all. In some cases, at least not as much as the surface food webs. So at the bottom of the ocean, there's total darkness without access to sunlight. But one way stuff at the bottom of the ocean in the darkness can survive is to eat something from the photosynthesis food web that falls down from above, right? You got stuff making food out of sunlight up there. It comes down and you eat it. But another way is to skip the sunlight-based nutrition, get your energy from the heat and chemical-rich waters around deep-sea hydrothermal vents. So deep down at the bottom of the ocean, you've got these places where you've got heated minerals gushing up out of the earth into the water. And around these vents, microorganisms form mats, which take in chemicals and minerals, for example, hydrogen sulfide escaping from the earth, and they oxidize it into sulfur. And this chemical reaction produces energy that can be used to create nutrition for the microbes. And thus, another type of food web is born. So other organisms might graze on the microbes mats and eat them or eat their byproducts. And then you've got a second round of eaters that feed on the first round and so forth. And hydrothermal vents are just amazing. You've also got these giant tube worms that actually live in a mutualistic relationship with the chemosynthetic vent microbes. The microbes provide the worms with nutrition, and the worms provide the microbes with shelter. But so where did chemosynthetic bacteria come from in the Monterey shipwrecks? Well, the authors of the NOAA report suggest a process. They say, you know, probably first wood-boring organisms come in and consume the wooden parts of the ship. And then this converts stored chemical energy in the wood into bioavailable nutrients. And then they write, quote, as organisms devour these nutrients, increased respiration causes the development of anoxic conditions without oxygen and sulfide production by sulfate-reducing bacteria. As a result, the shipwrecks are producing conditions similar to those of other deep-sea chemosynthetic habitats such as methane seeps and hydrothermal vents. So the shipwrecks here are like a new temple to the Hadean goddess of the hydrothermal vents. They provide a sort of analog of the conditions of hydrothermal vents that can allow similar organisms to thrive without anything escaping from the earth.
Yeah, this is interesting considering the wood here because, of course, for the vast majority of human history, ships were wooden. Like we were discussing the wooden ships and their issues with barnacles in the last episode. So, and of course, even ships with steel hulls are going to have a number of wooden components on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess in a way this would be a version of the other kind of survival down in the deep, which is surviving based on stuff from the photosynthesis web up above falling down. But this would be like converting that into, at later stages, into a parallel of the chemosynthetic food web. You end up with the same tube worms, the same chemosynthetic bacteria, the same sulfur-based food web, and the creatures of the deep sea Hades take root.
And of course, in all of this, you know, we were kind of glossing over the obvious that when a ship first sinks into the ocean, it may or may not contain, say, human beings or,
oh, right.
or other you know, can contain other organisms as well, chickens, goats, the gorilla and orangutan that we discussed in the most recent episode.
Oh no!
So there could be other forms of immediate sustenance aboard a ship as well.
A ship is like a box of chocolates that has various, you know, surprising morsels throughout, and you don't know what they're going to be until they land on the bottom and you explore.
Yeah, it could be full of primates. It could be full of plant life. It could be full of radioactive oil. You simply don't know.
What's the box of chocolates equivalent of radioactive oil?
Depends on the box of chocolates. Some of them, they're all radioactive oil. I'd say the ones that have the really fake cherry goo in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because those can be good if you have a really nice maraschino cherry inside of a chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
But very often you get the radioactive sludge version of that.
I'm more into the Luxardo cherries myself.
Oh, yes.
Okay, no. Back to the tube worms from Ocean Hill. So the Monterey wrecks are not the only ones where vent life has been discovered like this. For example, I found this one paper by Maria Cristina Gombi, Anya Schultz, and Inzio Amato called Record of Lamellibrachia, and then it lists several taxon names here, from a deep shipwreck in the Western Mediterranean Sea, Italy, in Marine Biodiversity Records 2011. And the authors report finding tube worms, Lamellibrachia, at a shipwreck site of a ship called the Catania, which was sunk in 1917 on the bottom of a western basin of the Mediterranean Sea. And the authors write, quote, it needs still to be clarified which type of energy source the obligate symbiotic bacteria of these worms may use for nutrition, since no sulfur emissions can be documented on and around the shipwreck. The Catania contained some wooden structures and was transporting cotton balls and oil seeds. So here's some more little chocolate morsels.
Yeah.
Cotton balls and oil seeds. So the symbiotic bacteria may rely on degradation of these materials. This record stresses the importance of shipwreck as a possible stepping stone habitat for the large-scale dispersion of vestimentifera, meaning like vent life.
Hmm.
So that's really interesting. They're saying it's possible shipwrecks could serve as a stepping stone habitat to sort of walk communities of vent life from one scarce deep sea vent to another across the bottom of the ocean.
Well, this is interesting. I wonder if this means that The accidental sinkings of ships in human history have enabled populations from one vent to reach other vents that would otherwise been impossible.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an analogy for the surface. It's like, go back to the idea that there are these giant ship-sized airplanes flying around all the time and they crash pretty often. Mm-hmm. What if they crash and create, like, they're full of water and create an oasis in the middle of a desert that occasionally crashes allow plant life to, like, cross a desert barrier?
Right. Or I think you could also maybe draw some analogies to land bridges.
Yeah.
Enabling our ancestors to cross from one piece of land to another.
Yeah. So I think at this stage, this is just a hypothesis of the authors. We don't know for sure if this is the case. But what a fascinating idea if that's true. The fact that whenever a ship sinks, you could be enabling the spread of wildlife through the deep, dark desert.
I mean, it comes back to the idea of like the butterfly effect, right?
Yeah.
This one small change could unsettle an ecosystem or allow one invasive organism to completely invade this other habitat.
Yeah. Now, I guess on the other hand, we could at least say that it looks like whale carcasses might do a similar thing.
Yes.
So it wouldn't just be ships, but we'd be contributing every time the captain goes down with the ship. But back to Walker, he says, of course, on top of his comparison to the carcasses, shipwrecks can just generally have a very positive impact on benthic biodiversity because a shipwreck, like a sunken ship, creates habitats for colonization by all kinds of organisms, barnacles, sponges, bryozoans, and the fish that feed on those organisms. So in many ways, I think we really can think of a sinking ship as kind of like a giant inorganic whale carcass, I guess with a major difference being that ships are not covered in edible flesh, though they might have a wooden hull that might be edible to some organisms. They might be full of morsels of, mm-hmm. you know, organisms and food and stuff like that that partially fill this role. On the other hand, they might be full of poisons and toxins that leach out into the water and damage sea life. So you got these positive and negative effects coming along whenever a ship goes down.
Yeah, it could just be filled with gold coins and, you know, what are you going to do with that?
I mean, depends on if you're a tube worm that doesn't care or a greedy octopus that must have all the gold.
Yeah, you show up, you think you might get something to eat or some wood to munch on and it's just the amber room. What am I going to do with this?
Okay, so we've been talking about what happens to a shipwreck sort of in the short term when it goes down. But I was wondering what happens to a shipwreck over a long period of time after it goes down. So I want to look at a passage from another book. This is by Martin R. Spate and Peter A. Henderson, Marine Ecology Concepts and Applications from 2013. And Spate and Henderson say essentially that sunken ships can function as artificial reefs. This shouldn't be much of a surprise. In fact, ships are often sunk on purpose to create artificial reefs. Now, the wisdom of doing this might be somewhat questionable.
Right. I feel like this is one of those areas where it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking, well, anytime you scuttle a vessel and send it to the bottom of the sea, you're doing a favor to marine communities down there.
Right.
But of course, as we already discussed, that's not the case if your vessel is full of oil mm-hmm. or you just dropped it on top of a delicate reef environment.
Exactly right. So there are positives and negatives that come along with this. But literally, mechanically, what do scuttled obsolete warships and stuff like that do once they go down to the bottom? So first of all, the authors say they provide, quote, new, clean, hard substrates for the settlement of many sessile and sedentary species.
Like suddenly there's a lot of just new virgin territory that you could affix yourself to.
Exactly right. So sessile and sedentary species like coral generally make a base out of rocky surfaces. Like loose seafloor sediment does not provide a good place for them to lock down. So if you've got a lot of empty ocean floor that's just kind of mm-hmm. sandy out there, these organisms can't really find purchase there. That's not the way they make a living. They need a rock or they need a ship's hull. Second, they provide shelter and a complex habitat for fish that like to hide within and around physical structures rather than out in open water. And there are a lot of species like this where you can imagine when you go into a restaurant, would you rather be sitting at a table in the middle of the room with your back to the door or in a kind of secluded booth in the far corner?
Am I going to fetch a handgun from the toilet and assassinate a mafia don? I don't know. I guess it kind of depends on the restaurant.
Oh, wait, Robert, I don't know if I was getting into bad territory. Are you like a table preference? Like you'd rather be in the middle of the room?
Well, I mean, if the restaurant's good, hopefully you're not going to have a lot of choices. You're going to have to deal with it. You're going to have to deal with that table right next to the door and get a blast of cold air every time somebody opens it.
Oh, no, I'm not advising people to complain about their table. Don't do that. You look like such a jerk when you're like, I don't like this table. But no, I mean, most people, I think, would rather be secluded in the corner where you got your back to the wall. You're kind of ensconced in a protective little booth area.
Yeah, I guess there is a natural tendency to want that kind of seating. However, we've certainly heard people give like security advice where they say, all right, first thing you do when you go into a restaurant, you just go ahead and inspect all the exits.
Right.
Look for a handgun behind the toilet. Make sure you have your escape route. Like, I don't know. Like, yes, know how to get in and out of a building. But ultimately, like, if I'm going into and enjoy, say, some pizza or a sushi, what have you.
You want to be imagining what violence might ensue.
Yeah, I want to just assume that I'm going to get out of here in one piece and I'm not going to have to fight my way out with chopsticks or something. But that's kind of a human privilege.
Right.
There is certainly in an oceanic environment, you need to be prepared to fight your way out.
Right. Yeah. I would say generally the life of an ocean-dwelling organism is much more dangerous than your average restaurant. But even given our understanding of that, it's very natural to see. I mean, I don't want to compare fish and humans too much, but it's mm-hmm. natural to see how organisms like shelter.
Right.
You know, you like to have a place to hide, a place you can kind of like get under stuff and get inside stuff.
Yeah.
It makes you feel secure.
Yeah, a shipwreck is going to have a lot of little nooks and crannies that organisms could hide in, little naturally occurring caves. I was fortunate enough to get to snorkel over a shipwreck in Barbados a few years back. It was a World War I era vessel.
Wow.
And so it had plenty of time for stuff to, accumulate. You could still certainly, it was a big metal vessel, so a big steel vessel. So there's still plenty of it there. It was definitely a shipwreck. You could identify it as a human structure, but it was very well populated, and it's kind of haunting to swim over it, and you stare down into these dark recesses and see things swimming in and out of it, see all of this life that is thriving just all over the surface of the thing.
Do you constantly think you see a dark recess and you think, what would happen if I stuck my hand in there?
Oh, yeah. You think, what would happen if I dove down there and got lost in it? You see these documentaries in which people are diving not only down to shipwrecks but going inside them, and that that kind of
that gives me the willies.
Yeah.
So anyway, here's another advantage that sunken ships can provide to organisms that I found this one interesting and surprising. Spate and Henderson do not mention this one. I found this instead in some online materials from the Ocean Exploration Trust, which is associated with Bob Ballard, the undersea explorer.
Oh yes.
And so it's this, elevation above the seafloor. So like by climbing up higher off the ocean floor, they say, you give yourself better access to currents, moving streams of water within the ocean. So if you are, say, an immobile or mostly immobile organism like a flytrap anemone, you want to take root in a place where food sources will drift past you so you can grab and eat things as they float on by. It's kind of like a reverse drive-through.
Huh. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. You're able to essentially climb up into an area of greater traffic.
Like getting up in the wind.
Yeah.
So imagine sort of like plopping down a fresh, unoccupied combination of a reef and a cave system in the water. Obviously, things are going to want to take root. So shipwrecks can be especially attractive to marine life if they sink in a place with muddy or sandy seabed, like we've been talking about, since a sunken vessel will now be the only hard substrate around, and hard substrates are very valuable real estate in the ocean. In another way, we've already discussed the analogy of a desert oasis, but this is another way that a shipwreck can be kind of like a desert oasis at the bottom of the sea.
And then ultimately, there's often going to be something there for quite a while. Now, certainly with wooden vessels, those are going to deteriorate at a far faster rate, whereas steel-hulled ships are going to linger quite a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of Bob Ballard, I was watching a documentary a while back about his work and some of the undersea explorations that he's taken part in. And in one of them, they were looking at really ancient wrecks, Greek sailing vessels, and by this point in time, there was virtually nothing left. Like all the wood was gone, but you had the remnants of the cargo. There on the bottom, arranged more or less in the shape of the ship.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so another thing I do want to talk about is how you can have remains of a ship even after a lot of the wood is gone from mm-hmm. a wooden shipwreck, not just from the cargo. I mean, the stuff about the cargo is interesting because, yeah, you see like the ghost of the shape of the ship, and then inside there like the amphorae, like the wine jars or, the gold or something.
Yeah, or at least the shattered remnants of it, yeah.
Sometimes what happens to the remains of a ship is what's known as concretion. And Robert, I have attached an image for you to look at here in our notes. This is an image I put in of a concretion from the remains of the Queen Anne's Revenge, the flagship of the pirate Blackbeard. How do you say his name? Is it Edward Teach? It's spelled like Teach, but I want to say it's like Teach or something.
Teach.
I don't know.
I always said teach.
Okay. Well, I'm
teach sounds maybe it's nice and piratey.
Okay.
Yeah.
But he's going to teach you a lesson with his cutlass if you don't hand over all the booty. So Edward Teach, the pirate known as Blackbeard, he sailed around. He robbed ships. His flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, was sunk. I think it was sunk off the coast of North Carolina. I was reading a blog post by a North Carolina archaeologist named Courtney Page, who worked on the Queen Anne's Revenge project. And she was writing about how this process happens. You know, when people study sunken ships that contain iron elements, this often leads to the creation of what are called concretions. And these are interesting structures. As the name implies, they sort of resemble concrete. I was looking at this image of the one from the Queen Anne's Revenge, and it looks to me like a cement cow heart.
Or a deep-fried chicken cutlet is kind of what I was getting from. It looks like it could go on a biscuit.
Uh-huh.
It looks like it could go on a sandwich.
That'd be a real tooth-cracking sandwich, but yes. So concretions are formed out of a combination of products and processes. One is the corrosion of iron in seawater. Iron is corroded by the water, and that produces byproducts. But the concretion also incorporates, according to Page, sand, biological byproducts created by marine life forms. So anywhere there's iron in a wreck, concretions can form and spread around in nearby structures, even structures that are not made of iron. So you can have iron elements that are things like cooking pots or cannonballs or nails, studs, tools. And this leads to the fact that sometimes even in waters where organic materials like cloth and rope and wood would normally disintegrate over time, they can be preserved by their proximity to an iron object, which means they get encrusted with concretions and partially preserved.
Oh, wow. Almost like a fossilization, really.
Yeah, kind of. And some objects, like she gives the example of wrought iron objects, they often disappear and dissolve entirely in the water, leaving only their concretion byproducts behind. So you can't see the original thing, but you might be able to try to determine what it was by looking at this cement cow heart that formed around it.
Hmm.
Another interesting bit of shipwreck iron chemistry I want to look at is the rusticle. Robert, have you ever seen these before?
Yes, you included a picture, and this is something you see on a number of these documentaries where you're exploring a shipwreck.
Yeah, I think you see it on the Titanic, actually.
Yes.
And a rusticle is pretty simple. It's like an icicle made of rust. It happens when iron oxidizes in some deep sea wrecks, creating hanging formations of rusty material, which are sometimes inhabited by special species of bacteria. Rusticle-loving bacteria. And one more thing I got to mention. This doesn't really have anything to do with biology, but one of my favorite bits of shipwreck science trivia is that lead ingots from an ancient Roman shipwreck have been used in the 21st century to build a neutrino detector.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
I think it's supposedly because they were so old and sunken, the recovered lead ingots had much lower than average levels of natural radioactivity or something like that.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, you don't think about the modern scientists creating something and saying, all right, it's ready to go, but there's one missing component, and the only place we can get it is a sunken Roman vessel.
It sounds like the setup of a really contrived deep sea adventure movie.
Yeah.
The Deep 2, Finding Neutrino.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the more notable organisms that make their home in the shipwreck.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
All right, we're back.
Okay, so we've been talking about what happens when a ship sinks, its impact on marine biodiversity, and what happens to the ship itself, the materials it's made out of. But let's talk about some shipwreck life. A shipwreck sinks. We've mentioned a few organisms that sometimes move in and set up shop, but let's talk about some more.
Well, for starters, there are the shipworms that we talked a little bit about in the previous episode.
Shipworms.
Yeah, these are Teredo navalis. And alongside barnacles, they were once the scourge of wooden sailing vessels, certainly a functional sailing vessels. So it makes sense that they would feast on the remains of wooden vessels as well.
Okay.
So what they do is they drill into the wood, not to eat the wood, but for shelter. Yeah, any wooden structure is just going to be irresistible because they can just make a home in it.
I got a new blister and barnacles. The new expression should be shiver and shipworms.
Blister and barnacles was a saying?
Yeah, that's from Tintin. Isn't it?
Oh, huh.
That's what the old sea captain in Tintin. He says blister and barnacles. What's another cartoon sea captain that can yell shiver and shipworms?
I like shiver and shipworms more. I like it.
All right. Well, what if we just glance at a few studies that look into what kind of organisms set up shop at shipwrecks and see what they have to say?
Sure. Yeah. There's one study we looked at by Zentzen et al., and this was published in Marine Biodiversity back in 2006, titled Epifaunal Inventory of Two Shipwrecks from the Belgian Continental Shelf. So in this study, they identified 121 macrofauna species, and they estimated the number of species probably involved anywhere between 150 and 280.
So there were a lot of cnidarians, right?
Right.
So the cnidarians would be a large phylum of animals that includes jellyfish, coral, and sea anemones.
Yeah, clearly the type of organisms you might expect to find in a a coral environment or certainly a shipwreck environment.
Mm-hmm.
They also point out that the two-dwelling amphipod Jassa herdmani was also particularly abundant. But there was still a fair amount of variety between shipwrecks here just in this particular study that they couldn't completely explain.
Hmm. So every shipwreck's different.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of comes back to that idea, that hypothesis that we mentioned earlier about them being stepping stones between habitats and so mm-hmm. forth. Depending on where a ship falls, there are going to be different things perhaps in position to take advantage of it. And then, of course, it's going to depend on the nature of the wreck too.
Right. So the inherent conditions, like how deep is it, temperature of the water, salinity and all that kind of mm-hmm. normal stuff. But then also just what's nearby and has access to set up shop, like who can move in first.
Right. Because there are going to be some first responders, right? And the crab legions are probably going to be a little slower in getting there as opposed to certainly, the faster moving sharks.
Now, I'd wonder, like, are there qualities of certain boats or ships that make them more amenable to hosting lots of marine biodiversity than other ones?
Well, this was a question that was looked at in a 2007 marine ecology paper. This came from Walker et al., titled Spatial Heterogeneity of Epibenthos on Artificial Reefs, Fouling Communities in the Early Stages of Colonization on an East Australian Shipwreck.
We got that fouling again.
Yep.
So much fouling in the ocean.
And they point out that complexity of structure is key, enabling a complexity of colonization.
Okay. So if you've got like a lot of like little twists and turns and different kinds of structures on your shipwreck, that maybe will mean that more different types of organisms move in, and that's good for, a healthy ecosystem.
Yeah, lots of nooks and crannies, Think of it if it's a speedboat, like all, streamlined, it doesn't have eight toilets on it. And how attractive is that going to be versus a toilet barge? There's just nothing but toilets. There's just going to be so much more room to hide in that. This is a quote from this particular paper. Quote, "This study supports the notion that wrecks enhance local diversity and biomass within the habitat mosaic of their location, and habitat complexity may be an important mechanism for this, as demonstrated by the large spatial variability in the assemblages documented here."
So get those smooth boats out of here.
Yeah. I mean, I guess for the most part, though, vessels are not going to be that streamlined. Like, they're going to have a lot of nooks and crannies. They're going to have a number of compartments, right? Certainly the larger vessels.
Now, on the other hand, we've mentioned already that there, a shipwreck is not always a net positive for undersea biodiversity, that it can be very negative and not just the initial impact. Like one example that I was reading about as summarized in that book by Spate and Henderson earlier was about a fishing vessel that sank in 1991 on a coral reef in the Central Pacific Ocean. This was around the Palmyra Atoll. And this was described in a study by Work et al. In 2008, and they showed that by the year 2005, after this thing went down, so this is what, like 14 years later, there had been a phase shift in the ecosystem. So you had a naturally pretty diverse coral ecosystem that had been taken over by this aggressive organism called Rhodactis rhodostoma. And basically the authors come to the conclusion that, you know, when the ship came down, it obviously caused a physical disturbance when it sank on the reef. But then there were also changes in what kind of nutrients were available in the water and in pollutants that the boat was leaching out into the water. And this favored this new aggressive invasive species taking over the natural diverse coral habitat. And in light of the study, Spade and Henderson say, you know, maybe we shouldn't be so quick to think, yeah, sinking a ship, that's great for the undersea life.
Yeah, because basically if you're sinking it into an existing ecosystem, you could destabilize that ecosystem.
Yeah, and so this is yet another case where it seems like people may have been too quick to rush to judgment on the idea that forming an artificial reef is always just great. Mm-hmm. Like maybe we should hesitate to mess with undersea or not just undersea. Maybe we should hesitate to mess with ecosystems at all if we can help it.
Now, coming back to my own experiences snorkeling around a shipwreck, certainly one of the things that I was looking for, something that I'm just generally looking for if I'm just walking around in the surf anywhere.
Morphine.
Well, I want to find the morphine. I want to find that Spanish gold. But I also want to see an octopus.
Oh,
because
yeah.
That is a creature that can appreciate nooks and crannies.
I mean, the octopus is kind of like you would expect some kind of named kraken at the bottom of the ocean to be guarding the gold in the shipwreck, much like Smaug the dragon guards his mm-hmm. pile of gold in the Lonely Mountain.
Right. I mean, they are kind of like dragons of the sea, and they like their lairs. They like their middens.
Absolutely. So I was reading a section from a book about octopuses in shipwrecks. Well, the book isn't about octopuses in shipwrecks. The book's just about the octopus. It's called Octopus, the Ocean's Intelligent Invertebrate, from 2013 by Anderson, Mather, and Wood. Timber Press, and the authors here are writing about how octopuses often do inhabit shipwrecks. They say octopuses can be shy, and they tend to seek out shelter and enclosures in whatever forms they can find, and this often means in objects and structures made by human hands. So octopuses can sometimes be found living or at least hiding in everything from beer bottles to ancient wine jars, those amphorae we were talking about in the wrecks of Roman galleons. And there's even research showing that they like aged beer bottles better when they're covered in barnacles and other growths more than they like fresh beer bottles, presumably because the older beer bottles that get covered in stuff let less light through and it feels more like a solid rocky shelter.
Oh, yeah, of course. And then also, I mean, a number of, you know, the octopuses have the ability to mimic the surface, like naturally occurring surfaces.
Yes.
They're probably not glass bottles.
Yeah, and I think I should say it's a coincidence that these containers I mentioned held alcohol. Octopuses apparently sometimes also chill out in crab and lobster traps and stuff, which is great because that's shelter and it's a buffet. But there's a section of the book where one of the authors, Roland Anderson, is writing about his own experiences with octopuses and shipwrecks. So Anderson is writing about how, you know, he explores shipwrecks like off the Puget Sound area. And these shipwrecks often contain giant Pacific octopuses, which can be huge. These are like some of the biggest octopuses. They live to become as big as 400 pounds sometimes or 180 kilograms. And I want to read a quote here. He tells a particular story, quote, "Once while diving on the wreck of the clipper ship Warhawk in Discovery Bay off Puget Sound, I saw the greatest number of giant Pacific octopuses I'd ever seen on one dive. This full-rigged sailing ship caught fire and went down in 1883, and all that remained were the skeletal ribs of the ship's starboard side protruding from the sand bottom and a 100-foot-long or 30-meter-long pile of ballast rocks next to the ribs. 8 giant Pacific octopuses were living in the ballast pile, perhaps because there was little else to make a den out of nearby in the bay, only vast expanses of sand and mud. These octopuses made dens where they could, even though they were closer to each other than they would have liked. Instead of just a home, this was an octopus condominium."
Huh. Interesting. But also interesting, you know, he points out that it's forcing these creatures to live in closer proximity to one another.
Yeah. So even then, like, it's providing them with something that they like, which is the shelter, mm-hmm. but it's also maybe messing with what they would be naturally doing.
Right.
And shipwrecks can be such desirable habitats that octopuses will sometimes fight over them. Robert, did you ever see the video of the two octopuses fighting over who got to stay in the shipwreck from last year? It was in 2018.
No, I missed this.
So, okay, on April 13th, 2018, some NOAA scientists were observing a seafloor scene in the Gulf of Mexico, about 6,000 feet or about 1,800 meters deep. And there was an octopus of the species Musoctopus johnsonianus, which tried to enter a seafloor shipwreck, presumably to make a den. But the cavity of the shipwreck was already occupied by another octopus of the same species. The two octopuses start fighting, but the intruder seems to be on the losing end, and then it seems to grab hold of part of the wreckage, and it looks like it's trying to pull at it as if to rip it off. I'm not sure that's exactly what's happening. That's just what it looks like. And you can hear one of the scientists who's watching on the intercom saying, guys, if you could have your creature stop tearing apart the shipwreck, that'd be great. But what happens after the fight is the most interesting. The defeated octopus, who did not get to make a den in the shipwreck, retreats and then settles down in the mud and then starts writhing and wriggling all of its arms at once and churning up a cloud of sediment. And I'm like, what's going on here? Like, is it trying to bury itself and hide, or is this an expression of anger and frustration, like when somebody punches a wall? It's one of those many times you look at octopus behavior and you see some kind of maybe a little bit unsettling type of display of intelligence or something emotional or social that you're not expecting to see out of such an alien creature.
Yeah, a degree of complexity there for sure.
But shipwrecks, of course, probably make great sites for an octopus for multiple reasons. The octopus loves shelter to make itself an enclosed den. The wreck also functions as a food oasis, attracting prey organisms for the octopus to eat, especially in areas of otherwise like fairly boring, unoccupied, sandy or muddy seafloor. If you haven't seen this video of the octopuses fighting over the shipwreck, it's worth a look. You can Google it. It's pretty easy to find.
All right, so I feel like these examples do illuminate the benefits as well as the disadvantages of shipwrecks, how they can offer a number of organisms a new territory, new layers, and also eventually a new mini ecosystem in which to thrive.
But also all the downsides that can come with that. I mean, I'm reminded again of the dim moon-eyed fish that says, what does all this vaingloriousness down here?
Yeah.
Apparently what it does is attract chemosynthetic food webs and tube worms and leech oil.
Now, certainly we could easily do an entire episode on oil spills alone, not only to marine environments, but coastal environments as well.
Oh, yeah. I was reading a Scientific American article about how the Deepwater Horizon oil spill may mm-hmm. have altered some of these shipwreck ecosystems in the surrounding area because, like, oil spills could speed the corrosion of shipwrecks.
Interesting.
And, of course, affect the wildlife directly.
Right. And then if there's anything within those shipwrecks that could leach out due to that corrosion, it's kind of a domino effect, it would seem.
Right. So I'd say we touched on several things today that we could return to, much like a shipwreck from which we have not recovered yet all of the sunken Spanish gold.
Yeah, or the odd atomic weapon here and there, that sort of thing. It would be interesting if you had like a God's eye view of everything, and you could essentially look at a list of all the things that have been lost and remain lost on the bottom of the ocean. What would that list consist of?
I think this is where some true nerd out there would make a joke about the second season of Firefly or something.
Oh, yes, because they actually filmed it and then put it all on DVD.
Down in Davy Jones' locker.
Davy Jones' locker. Where an octopus just lords over it next to its stash of morphine and gold coins.
Well, Robert, this has been fun.
Yeah, this has been fun. I feel like the shipwreck territory, on one hand, maybe seemed like it was going to be like a little more straightforward, but I do feel like we discussed some dimensions to the disruption of shipwrecks that maybe hadn't been as obvious to a number of listeners. Now, certainly, we know that we have some divers out there who listen to the show. We would, of course, love to hear from anyone who has experience diving down to shipwrecks and observing the kind of ecosystems that that thrive in at these locations. We'd also love to hear from just anybody with nautical experience and experience dealing with barnacles and shipworms and what have you. So that's it for this episode. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes. You can also click on the merchandise store at the top of that page, and you can buy some stickers, some shirts. This is a great way to support the show. And if you want to support the show without spending any money at all, you can simply rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. We'd like to encourage you again to look up and subscribe to our new show, Invention. That's another great way to help us out. And you get a whole nother show in the bargain. It publishes every Monday. Each episode is a look at a particular invention, how it changed the world, and how that change came about.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.